On this extended edition of The Big Show, we'll talk with Harley Quinn's Bird of Prey co-stars Mary Elizabeth Winstead, Rosie Perez, and Journey Smollett-Bell. We'll also meet the February DC Filmmaker of the Month, Frankie Bars, and hear the second half of two-time Oscar winner Russell Williams' conversation about the Academy Awards. And also, we'll review the Netflix Willie T. Ribbs documentary, Uppity, all on this extended episode of The Big Show, keeping it real with Film Gordon Overtime. Welcome to this extended overtime edition of The Big Show, keeping it real with Film Gordon. Coming up a little later on in overtime, we will have a review of the new Willie T. Ribbs Netflix documentary, Uppity. And when you listen to it, you'll understand why it's called Uppity. Also, the cast and the ladies of the Birds of Prey, Mary Elizabeth Winstead, Rosie Perez, and Journey Smollett-Bell, will come and stop by and talk about this new film that's in theaters this weekend. We'll continue our conversation with two-time Oscar winner, two-time Emmy Award winner, Russell Williams. And momentarily, Charles Kirkland sits down with the DC Filmmaker of the Month for the month of February. That's Mr. Frankie Bars. And let's check out their conversation.
And welcome back to the show. I'm Charles Kirkland, and we've come to the favorite time of the month. The one thing that we love to do every month is greeting the filmmaker of the month, the DC filmmaker of the month. And I've got this month, I've got two people in the office instead of just one. Sitting down with me is a hip hop innovator, a hip hop ambassador, a media personality who got to start as a freelance videographer and television producer in Atlanta, and then he brought all that back here to Washington, D.C. with us. He's crusading a lot of things in the city, everything from statehood to legalization of marijuana to all kinds of things. He's got a video vlog that is hilarious and entertaining and educational, and I'm honored to say that the February Filmmaker of the Month is the one, the only, Frankie Bars. And I'm welcoming Frankie Bars to the DC Radio Studios. Welcome to the show, brother. How
are
you doing?
Thank you, thank you. Hello, hello. I am doing great. Thank you all for having me.
All right. And also with Frankie is his photographer.
Videographer. Camera operator. Cinematographer.
Chez Carter. And he's sitting in with us as well. So welcome to you as well.
And thank you for having me here.
All right. So as we always start, the first question I ask is, you've been named the Filmmaker of the Month for the month of December by DC Radio. What does that mean to you? How does it feel?
For the month of February, it's really excellent. I'm looking forward to February. It makes me very happy. It makes me feel very good.
I see you got on a button that says I love black people, and February, of course, is Black History Month. So to be recognized in such a way like this, in such a wonderful month for us, how does that make it any more important for you?
Yes, definitely, definitely. I'm all about representing my culture. I'm very proud to be from Africa, you know, from Ethiopia, from Kush. We're a special people, and it makes me very happy and honored to be able to be honored as an African-American filmmaker in the month of February.
All right. So it's not your first time being recognized for something. As a matter of fact, your video, Be Free, which is about statehood for Washington, D.C., won a couple awards. Can you talk about it, the D.C. Voice Award and some other things?
Yes. Well, I had the opportunity to make micro history in Washington, D.C. by winning the first ever film festival for D.C. statehood. So the organizers, the trailblazers of D.C. statehood, decided to start an annual film festival for D.C. statehood. And the first one was last year. I entered in for the first one, and luckily won first place of the original DC Statehood Film Festival, of the first annual.
So the short film is called Be Free, and it's actually, it's like a music video, but it has an interlude in them. It's one of those extended music videos because it's got some more weight to it than just the music. But it's a very interesting video. I enjoyed it. I love a lot of the scenes that you put in it from around the city inside it. But there's this one thing I need to ask you. Who is Mega Looch?
Oh, Mega Looch. So Mega Looch, she is the singer that was featured on the song.
Okay.
And she's a vocalist.
How'd you come to meet with her and hook up with her on this project?
I met her at an open mic, but more so like a music networking event / open mic at, I believe it was a arena stage over by Arena Stage on Waterfront. And they would have like these music networking events. And I met her and we started grooming and started building together. And we did a vlog together. And then we evolved in our business relationship and we ended up doing a television. She ended up being a guest on my television show, the Frankie Barr Show. And then she also ended up being an artist on a rap concert that I helped produce with a nonprofit organization called Free DC. So the Secretary of State at the time blessed us with a grant to produce a rap concert in dedication to DC Statehood. So we had to find artists to make a song about DC Statehood, and it was a contest. So my job was to recruit artists for the rap concert, and Mega Looch was one of those performers. And based on our track record, I was like, yeah, we might as well make a song. Yeah, we might as well make a film.
Chemistry was there.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it looks great. So I guess that's the next question I have is, how did you get involved in this initiative, the Statehood Initiative? What drove you to being a part of the pushing
story
for this?
It's really random for real. So basically, a person that's associated with my family invited me to Vincent Orange's Super Bowl party. Vincent Orange, well, he's now the president of the Chamber of Commerce, but at the time he was running for office. He was running to be council member. And so I would go to his campaign events, and I ran into the U.S. representative, Franklin Garcia. Mm. And he approached me, and he asked me, could I make him a drink? And I asked, because I asked him to sign my petition. And at first I'm like, is this a trick question? He was like, oh, what are you drinking? Can I get what you're drinking? So I made him a drink, right? And we started talking, and I told him what I was trying to do with the videos, and we were just having a casual conversation. And he said that, you know, he was the U.S. representative of D.C., and he started showing me his pictures and how he represented statehood. And I was telling him, you know, how I was looking to grow in the business and, you know, sell my video services. And he was like, well, I can't pay you, but I can give you access to the council. And we can, you know, we will work on, you know, DC Statehood together and rep that cause. So he invited me out to an event, which was the Chinatown Parade. And when I went out to that event, I looked up and I was like, in the VIP section were like the Chinese government and like, wow, the council member of Ward 8. And I was like looking around, I was like, all these like elected officials and stuff. I'm like, what? So when he asked me to go to the parade, I was thinking I was just gonna be, you know, a pedestrian. The next thing I know, I was in the parade, and I was holding up a DC Statehood flag, and I was like, "Yo, this is tight," and I just stayed with it. And within about 3 years, I became the first award-winning filmmaker at the DC Statehood Film Festival.
Cool, cool. So I've watched some of your show, and you deal with a lot of things, the Frankie Barr's show, and again, I love what you're doing with it. I mean, you have this wonderful way of relaxing everyone when it comes to the show. When you talk about, I'm the host, I got the hat on, you know, this, that's cool. And one of the issues they talked about, and they do a lot of stuff with law and art, and you would never think that the two of them would go together. But yeah, the way you present it is very educational about how art affects law and how law affects art.
Yeah.
And I remember, and you were talking about how all of a sudden you didn't know how you're all wrapped up in this.
Yeah.
You got to start down in Atlanta, and it's very different down there versus up here as far as the legal structure and how you can get into the law. I mean, one minute you're hobnobbing with the city council members and the mayor and mayor's representatives, where down in some place like that, another municipality, it wouldn't happen so easily. What do you think some of the differences are between the experience that you made in Atlanta and what you've got here in Washington, D.C., and what makes Washington, D.C. better?
Well, it really was a lot of differences that I had to equalize. Like, I always saw it as one thing because it was coming from me, you know, as far as, like, the art and policy. Anybody in the business who understands the business and is a creator knows that you don't have art without the business. You don't have music without the business. You don't have film without the business. Any artist who is a businessman or a woman knows that they go together. The public, the general public, aren't as educated on the basics and just the module built around law and film, or just law and music, art and law. So I felt my responsibility, and I would have this fight with both sides. Like in Atlanta, I would be with the artists, you know, shooting with the artists and trying to explain to them the importance of politics and be like, no, man, we just want to paint. We just want to sing. We just want to rap, you know. And then I'll be working with the congressman in D.C. and he'd be like, man, no, we don't want to hear no rap. We don't want to hear no rap. We need to wear pins and we need to wear suits and we need to be elected officials and woo-woo. So with me being on both sides and navigating on both sides, I felt like it was my responsibility to merge the two and show the other side how important the other side is. Mm-hmm. To show the art side, you don't have art without policies. And to show the politicians, you don't have an agenda without a voice, without artists sharing the importance of their message. So I do think I would obviously say that D.C. has more benefits than Atlanta in certain ways. I wouldn't necessarily say D.C. is better. I could, you know, but both of them is in me. As far as the art, you know, Atlanta is known for that. As far as, like, policy and law, D.C. got that.
Right.
You know, so they both have their own strengths. So I just felt like it was a good niche for me, and it was my responsibility coming from both and having them both in me to show the balance between. I love Atlanta for the art and entertainment. I love, you know, D.C. for the law and policy. But eventually, they do both have to come together.
Mm-hmm. So, I love the show again. Like I said, Frankie Barr's show. To tell me, who is the demographic for your show? I mean, when you sit down and you're plotting out what you're going to do on the show, and who do you think is watching? Who do you want to see this? Who are you making this for?
So it's mostly creators, people who love to be creative, and people who are interested in law.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, I love the way that you do it because you it's kind of like Mr. Rogers in a way, where you come in and you set the tone of what you're going to talk about, and then you throw it out to these segments and give the people the rein to talk about whatever their area of expertise is, whether it's a drummer, whether it's a lawyer, whether it's an activist. They all get to say what they have to say, and then it comes back to you and you put it all together.
Yeah.
Did you ever watch Mr. Rogers growing up?
Definitely. I was a huge Mr. Rogers fan. I loved Mr. Rogers. Like, that was the show, young. That was the jump. I loved Mr. Rogers. My grandma put me on Mr. Rogers. Definitely.
Well, I asked that because, again, like I said, it has that kind of feel to it. And I don't know if you intentionally do it that way.
You know what's so funny? That really wasn't on purpose, for real. It just came out like that. You know, I never really like, oh, I want to be like Mr. Rogers. It just, I guess it just comes out like that. Because when I rap, it's a total different personality. It's a total different purpose. And people tell me that. They be like, man, you're like two different animals, like two totally different personalities. Like, when you're hosting, you're like a black Mr. Rogers, but when you rap, you just get raw. You know, and it's like, I don't know, it's just me. I didn't try, it's just, this is how it comes out.
Okay, all right. So, Chez, you're working here with Frankie Barrs. Can you tell me any any nuggets of wisdom, or what's it like to work with him, or, you know?
You know, it's working with Frankie is interesting because you kind of get to observe, you know, how someone is when they have a vision and they really, really want to go after it and they're willing to do whatever it takes to get it. You know, so it's been really inspiring just to be a part of his team. You know, I remember when we shot an event one night and we had to get a couple different interviews and things would happen, random things. Battery, the camera would run out and we had to take apart the entire gimbal rig just to put another camera battery in there. And Frank would be so persistent in making sure that it happened because he was so passionate about getting the proper shot, mm-hmm. you know, having two angles for an interview. Yeah. Whereas I may have been like, okay, let's just use one camera, but I could see he was willing to go to the top to ensure the best quality possible. So, you know, it's been inspiring just being around the energy.
And I'll confess, I know he has a love for photography and for videography because when I came in, he was here with his camera snapping and looking and getting the shot and the angles and everything. And even right until we were recording, he's, you know, fiddling with that camera, getting things right.
And he's so into it.
He's very... when you hear Chez say things like this about you, how is that rewarding to you? Is it inspiring to you? How does it make you feel?
No, it makes me feel good. You know, it makes me feel really good. I'm very appreciative to have Chez. I really am. Because, I appreciate it being inspirational. I know I can be very intense sometimes. Like a lot of people that I work with, you know, think I'm very intense, you know. And it reminds me of like a lot of other great producers and directors that I look up to or that I know of. They're known for being very intense. But that intensity is what pushes greatness. That fire is what produces the gold. So I'm appreciative that Chez is able to understand his inspiration, and I'm glad that he's able to, you know, follow my lead and just know how to, you know, go with the flow and be able to handle the fire and look at it as the ambition and inspiration.
We're very big here about giving back, about, you know, inspiring the next generations that come behind us. We work with youth, we work with children, showing them the other side of the business. Not always, because a lot of times we talk about being in front of the camera, you know, but there's a lot of stuff, opportunities that are behind the camera. Mm-hmm. And I just love the fact that you're educational in that nature, telling people about the other side of the business, not just being in front of the camera, but what's happening behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. And I applaud you for that. I applaud you for that.
Thank you.
All right. So, tell us where we can find your work. If somebody wanted to say, I need to check this guy out, Frankie Barrs, where can they go to find anything about you?
The main place where I need people to engage is my YouTube. It's youtube.com/FrankieBarrs. It's FrankeKey, and Frankie as in Frankie, like key, like I'm coming in the dough, I got the keys. And Barrz. So it's FrankeBarrz. YouTube.com/FrankieBarrs. And you can also follow me on Instagram. I am Frankie Barrs. Twitter is I am Frankie Barrs. And Facebook is I am Frankie Barrs.
You hear me chuckling as he's talking about the keys because that's a key thing for him whenever he comes in the show. He talks about, I got the keys. So it's a pleasure to have you, my brother. Keep up doing the good work that you're doing and keep inspiring people. And congratulations for being the filmmaker of the month.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
And thank you for coming in, Chez.
And thank you for having me.
All right. And we'll be back. Wishing me listen, I glisten like sun and water while fishing. Bust the move and it's worth. Serve words with nerve embedded, I said it word. You nerd, man, you heard. Coming from the town of Illy and alleys are full of fillies and rallies. Suckers get silly and sally, them found in alleys and rally. Really? So here we go. Now holla if you hear me though. Come and feel me. Flow. Never nixing with tricking brothers. No for fixes that ain't fitting to. All right, and welcome back to Big Show. Keeping it real with Film Gordon. I am Tim Gordon. Charles Kirkland is sitting in with us now, joining us. Welcome, Charles.
Hey, what's up, y'all?
All right, and before we get to we move on to our segment, this Sunday night is the Academy Awards. Yes. They told me that I have to say this, that I am hosting or co-hosting the Oscar party for the DC Film Society along with my colleague in crime, Travis Hobson. Doors open at 7 o'clock for red carpet.
Six
o'clock, I'm sorry, for red carpet. I will be Natalie attired as I am every year. So, you know, come out, meet your favorite critics, watch the Academy Awards, do what you do.
I'll be there.
Yeah, whatever. Having said that, online with us is a young man that I remember meeting at the onset of his career. He is a D.C. native, and I'm just being sarcastic when I say that because I don't want to get embarrassed when he finally does come on and say hello. He is a two-time Oscar winner, two-time Emmy Award winner. He is a professor at American University. There's a whole lot I can say about this guy, but I will simply say, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the show, Russell Williams.
Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you, Tim, for the invite. As always, the big show is Sunday, as you said, and a lot sooner than I was expecting and most other voters, so we'll start from there.
All right, we'll start from there, man. All right, so, I mean, I didn't ask you this, but, you know, I just want to, is it ever cool to reveal what you voted on?
Actually, it's against the Academy policy.
Uh-huh.
It's not like they send out people in black suits with handcuffs to arrest you. And especially now since it's an all-digital process.
Right.
Right there before you hit the enter button, there is a card that says, please do not share any information about your votes on social media with the press, blah, 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 to not tarnish the process of and so on. But now they do let you keep a copy of what you voted on if you want to.
Well, no, the reason I was asking, Russell, is because earlier this week I got a text, I guess, from Variety, and I guess
right. They
had some anonymous, I saw something like, here's another secret ballot. I'm like, what are these secret ballots? How are you getting your hands on secret ballots, Variety?
Well, what happens is I'm assuming that, because Variety, Hollywood Reporter, and I think Deadline also have people, like, as they say, anonymously, will tell them what they voted on, how they voted, so why they like Sarjo in two or three different movies, and why they think that 1917 will win, even though they like Marriage Story better for Best Picture. I'm like, where were you sitting? and then in past years, one of the things that I like about those anonymous votes, especially when I'm in class, I can show the students the wide-ranging opinions about these performances and things like that. I mean, so, you know, sometimes it seems like, you know, it may be racially motivated, but you can tell by some of these voters that they may be white and they still didn't like some of those performances because they thought it was derivative or it was a sympathy vote or the movie was like, you know, just laid up on the screen like somebody's bad painting. I mean, you see some really cold comments. I mean, I was like, whoa, okay. So this does seem that there's some thought process that goes into it, but you know, each Academy, and I'm talking about TV, music, motion picture, they're all under the microscope now for many reasons.
So let me just ask you a question. I just want to go back a couple of weeks, man. I think I sent you an article. We were having a discussion back and forth online about these, I guess, members of the Academy who were weighing in on certain people who didn't get nominations, and they were giving these reasons. And I can't remember who the actual Academy member was, but as it related to Eddie Murphy, they talked about him being snubbed at, I think the phrase was, and I'm paraphrasing, is that he wanted it too much. He was out there campaigning, and he was trying too hard.
Yeah. I did see that, yeah.
I mean, Russell, I've heard people say in certain years that this person didn't get a nomination because he didn't go out there and make himself available to the press and to voting Academy members and didn't campaign.
Right.
Then you have somebody said he campaigned too much, or I mean, is there any rhyme or reason? I mean, I know this might be a rhetorical question, but I want your opinion because you're an actual voter in the room. Is there an actual way that somebody is supposed to campaign, or is all that caca and it depends largely on if this person is liked, what the movie's prospects are, right. If the person has never gotten one before, if they... Right. Break it down for me, Russell.
Yeah, I mean, I would say, based on that article that I read that you sent, it was, I would think that was a question, and a rather response to say, I didn't vote for Eddie Murphy because either I didn't like the movie, I don't like Eddie Murphy, or whatever. Because
he tried,
you know,
too hard.
The studios or the distributors or however you want to define, you know, because we have, like, Netflix is now an MTA member. To Disney, to all these other companies and the independent companies that don't have the war chest, you have to get out there in front of voters. I think it's even more critical this year than it has ever been because you have, I'll put it this way, in my era, I would not have known that I was even nominated yet. Our nominations would have been somewhere around Valentine's Day, and of course the Oscars were out in March. So you had a fairly decent amount of time even after the calendar year was ended to look at some of the smaller projects. You never have a problem finding the big studio releases because they're there. But like movies like, say, for instance, Black and Blue, as far as I know, they didn't even send out a DVD.
Wow.
Movies like Waves and things like that, yeah, they had a DVD and or a secure screener. But I would say for one reason, that the reason why Harriet turned out to be the nominee for Best Actress for Cynthia and also for Best Song is that Focus Films kept that movie in front of people the entire nominating season. And after they got nominated, then they kept them going to parties and doing screenings and things like that. So unless you cross the Academy line, which actually they did rescind a nomination for a gentleman who's a 19-time nominee because he was accused of calling people on the phone and saying, vote for me.
Wow.
I know this person. I love this person, right? He has never, that I can remember, called me and said, vote. He would say, have you seen the movie, and blah, 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 and so forth and so on, and then that's it. You know, that's as much campaigning as I've ever actually personally experienced from him as an individual. But of course, you know, the studios are going to go out there, they're going to buy ads, you know, they're going to give you parties, they're going to give you dinners. I'm not even going to say what happens with you critics, but you know, at the end of the day you're not going to vote because they gave you a dinner. You're going to vote because, you know, you like what was on the screen. But I think it does help you remember these projects as they all turn into one big ball at the end of the voting season, and you got to say, oh my goodness, what did I like in this area, what did I like in this area. But if you don't campaign, so many of the movies that I thought were really great performances in the independent space, they didn't campaign, or they didn't have, maybe they just sent out a DVD, and maybe people are just getting to that part of the pile of DVDs. It's too late now.
All right. Well, you know what, man? We're going to talk picks in a minute, man. But I want, for many people who have never heard, I mean, you and I have usually do this show once a year. And I always want you to give us an insider look. So, because you've actually attended the Academy Awards. What? I know you attended as a nominee twice, but I'm sure you've been back. Talk to me about Sunday morning when you're a nominee at the Academy Awards. What is your day? What was your day, Russell?
Okay, well, as a nominee, I'll say it's generally cheaper than when you buy the ticket and have to put yourself there, you know, because whatever studio you work for that got nominated, they're going to provide the limo. They're going to buy the tickets for the seats. You also have tickets for the Governor's Ball, which is a big shindig directly, immediately following the broadcast. So if you're a person that needs makeup and hair, you have makeup and hair people there at your house or wherever you're getting prepped to fluff you and puff you. If you're wearing something from Armani or from Tom Ford or something, those clothes have already been provided, and maybe you're slipping into them and trying on two or three different pairs of shoes. If you're one of the kind of folks who have They're on a first name basis with Van Cleef and Arpels and Tiffany. If you've been given permission to wear a big diamond necklace on the event, I think they meet you at the venue. You get the diamond necklace before the actually walk the red carpet, and they're there to take it from you immediately after the governor's ball or after the ceremony if you're not going to the governor's ball. And then it's a long day in line with limo after limo after limo, regardless of what venue you're in. Obviously, there's more security now than there would have been in the 2 years in 90 and 91 when I was actually a nominee. The only other time I went back as a paying customer was in 2011 because that was my 20th anniversary of being a two-time Oscar winner. And there was a lot more security. The red carpet had three lanes in it instead of just one lane where you could kind of mingle and chit-chat. And then you go into the event, and then if you're not a nominee, unless you're a big star that was invited by the studio, and whether you actually are presenting or not, they probably still get to go to the governor's ball. But if you pay for those front row seats, sometimes you don't even have a ticket for the governor's ball even after that. I'm sure for the upper decks, you don't have a governor's ball ticket. So, yeah, I would say it's cheaper as a nominee in many ways. Even if you're, especially if you're an actor and you're out of the country, they will fly you back over if you plan to attend. All right. That's part of the studio's war chest.
All right, so we set up the pre-show. Now, during the show, you were honored enough to win one, and you're sitting in your seat holding an Oscar. And then you go to the governor's ball. So let me ask you a question. I'm not sure if they were doing it then, but I know now at the governor's ball, from what I understand, they have someone there who's an engraver that, you can take your Oscar there, and then they will engrave the plate while you're at the governor's ball. Were they doing that back in 90 and 91?
Hell no. and as I recall, because I when I went back in 2011, of course I wasn't a nominee, but as I recall, that happens backstage even before you return to your seat.
Wow, that they engrave it?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, absolutely, because they've got it's computerized. They have the badges, and they already have each category already locked into the computer. So it's just a matter of it was Tim Gordon at one, so okay, we'll pull his out. And if he had, partners, if it's a shared award like sound is, and there are two or three other people with you. But, yeah, the years I was there, they asked you the dumbest question I've ever heard, which is, okay, so first of all, on the bottom of the statuette is a number. So each statuette is unique in that regard. And of course, at that time, there's no badge on it, so they ask you 2 seconds after they've handed to you, do you want to leave it with us? And then in a week or two, when we get the badges, we'll affix it and you can come pick it up. And I'm like, no. Okay. So then you can take it with you without the badge. And I'm like, yes. And then when we have the badges, mailed to us, then you can come to the Academy and have it put on. I'm like, yes, thank you. Because how am I going to get in the party without this Oscar?
Right. That's a good point.
I mean, I'll get in the governor's ball, sure, but I'm saying after that, if I wanted to go to Spago's or even there, I don't even think they had the Vanity Fair party back then. But I being a behind the camera person, it's like, yeah, you want an Oscar tonight? Okay, where is it? Well, next.
I love how he said, "How was I gonna get in these parties without this Oscar?"
I got an Oscar with me. So, I'm not Denzel. I don't have that face recognition. But there was one person in my era who had an Oscar in his hand, who had facial recognition, and could not get in Spago's party.
Wow. Hold that thought, man. Stick a pin in that. We're going to take a break right now. We're going to come back on the other side. I'm talking to two-time Oscar winner Russell Williams about all things Oscar. You guys keep it where you got it, and we'll be right back. And we'll come back with more on Overtime. You guys keep it where you got it. We'll be right back.
When I walked into the office, what did I see? A well-shaped body with the back to me, sitting in a chair, whipping a white gown. She said,
Dana Dane, won't you please lay down?
She said that she wanted to reveal her face till my hour was up and I was on my way. Now we got to the matter of why I came there. I said, Doc, I keep having these crazy nightmares. Nightmares of the night. No.
life is still right. Just show imagination.
All right, and welcome back to this extended edition of Overtime. And we have Russell Williams II, man. Love this brother, man. So, Russell, as you were saying.
I was going to say, we got to go
back. Yeah, man, we got to go back to the story. So, we were talking about you using the Oscar to almost like, yo, man. Membership has its privileges. Come on in.
Come on.
So I now, mean, but your boy Spike Lee told a story about one time he showed up. He didn't have an Oscar, and he had Wesley Snipes with him, and could not get into the governor's ball. And they told that story when he won his honorary Oscar like 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. So wow. So even with the Oscar, go ahead.
Well, I have trouble believing that because if he was a nominee that year, was he a nominee or he just went to the Oscars?
I could swear he probably wasn't a nominee, man, because this was before he won, and this was before he had an honorary. So no, he just went to the party at Spike Lee with Wesley Snipes.
Right. Okay. Because as a nominee, you'll get your ticket based on, like, whatever craft you're in, if you're an actor or director or doc or foreign language back in those days, you would have a ticket down in the orchestra section in the section of seats where your category would all stand from. Mm. And you also have a ticket to the governor's ball if you're a nominee. That's automatic. So he was probably just at the party. But what happened with me, back in those days, there was a place called La Dome on Sunset. And so that was one party we were going to, and right across the street is Fargo's. Now, the only reason that I got into Fargo's party is because Morgan Freeman, who was there that night, I want to say, for Driving Miss Daisy, he says, oh, yeah, and, you know, we're going to Fargo's later. If you and your wife want to come, I'll put you on the list. So I said, well, sure. Well, you know, who am I to say no? You know, so the limo line going to both of those places was so long, we literally got out of the limo and walked down Sunset Boulevard a bit, walked up the hill to Spago's, and people were going in, they were checking the names on the list, and so I'm nervous. I got the Oscar in my hand, you know, I got this fine woman on my arm, but then I get there and I'm like, okay, so my name is Russell Williams. And he looks in there. He says, yes, Mr. Williams, go right on in. I'm like, he's on my way to the chair, right? But the person with an Oscar in his hand that had just won for Best Director was not on the list, and he could not get in.
Yikes. Wow.
And his name is Oliver Stone.
Oh, no. Wow. All right. Okay. Man. That was good, Russell, because I thought you weren't. I didn't think you were going to give me a name. That was good.
Oh no! I mean, and I mean, he was out there pleading with this guy, and I wanted to speak up for him, but I'm like, well, wait a minute, you know, stay in your lane.
You didn't want to be. You want to be taken off the list.
Absolutely, you know, I'm not here on my own behalf. Morgan Freeman knew my name, so I'm just going to keep accepting. But I couldn't believe that. That's how strict they were. And, I mean, everybody was in that party.
Wow.
You know, but as far as I know, he never got in.
All right. I want to pivot back to this year's award show, and I want to ask you a question. And I'm not asking you to reveal a vote. I'm going to tell you that I think in the top five categories, out of the five, the top six, because, you know, we talk actor, actress, supporting actor, supporting actress, director in film. I think five of those I have cold, right? So I think it's, of course, Joaquin Phoenix for Best Actor, Renee Zellweger for Best Actress, Brad Pitt for Best Supporting Actor.
Looking good.
I have Laura Dern as a lock for Best Supporting Actress for Marriage Story. And I think Sam Mendes is going to take home Best Director this year for 1917. Now, the controversy comes in because Parasite, I think, is really surging. I think that the safe Academy bet would be 1917 for Best Picture. By virtue that Parasite is going to win the international film, which was formerly the foreign language category, I'm not really sure if a foreign language film has ever done both, like one foreign language, and it's never been done, right?
Never been
because
done.
I think that the voters, and again, I'm speaking for me, and then I'm going to throw it to you to get your kind of like first in-person impression. I think that since they already have this category, people look at it and go, you know, we don't give foreign language best picture because, you know, we just put it in the international category. But right, people right. are thinking that Parasite has an opportunity to upset this year.
And before you answer, Russell, I'm of the opinion that I think Bong Joon-ho has the opportunity to beat Sam Mendes in the director category, and then his movie Parasite will not win. 1917 will win. Deakins is a lot for cinematography.
Oh, absolutely. I agree.
Yeah, so I think so.
I think there's a chance that Bong Joon-ho could win at the director spot.
I think, but go ahead, Russell. We want to hear what you have to say about this.
Okay, so let's go back to Joaquin. I think there was probably no chance that he wouldn't get Best Actor. The only thing that gives me pause is because he didn't accept the BAFTA award, and the voters still had the ballots on their computers. I mean, if you've already
I thought the votes were in.
Yeah, the votes were in Tuesday at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. So it's kind of like if you think that he'll win, but he won't accept the Oscar, then should we so-called waste the Oscar, or should we give it to him because that's the performance that we thought was head and shoulders above the rest in any case, whatever he says. So that's the only, you know, that's why I said stick a pin in that because I'm not sure if anybody's seen. I have seen that happen before, and I can't say for sure because we can't see.
Russell Crowe for Beautiful Mind when Denzel won. Yeah. Yep. It has happened, yeah.
And he made a fool of himself at the BAFTAs, and I bet those actors said, check this out. Okay. I think the other thing that might be because the Academy's plural have all come under such scrutiny, and because the with all the new diverse members, the results of the nominations were fairly like any other year, it may be a statement that the Academy says, you know what, Parasite should get Best Picture. Even though it's still, and then there were some other really good international films, but it could come in there, and because there would be more of a protest. But I'm not saying that Parasite isn't worth Best Picture. The safe vote obviously is 1917 because that's the kind of film that we default to as an Academy, more conservative, you know. But and then as far as who gets director between the two of them, because I mean both of those movies really are very strong. I mean, but I'll say as a viewer, I did not see Parasite coming, you know. So I think in terms of storytelling, it's much edgier than 1917, even though of course it was well done, and even though Deakins gets all the credit for the cinematography, it's really the editing that makes it feel like it's all one shot.
Right.
You know, so I'm thinking it might be a lock for editing. It's going to be interesting on Sunday. But as always happens, gentlemen, they're going to be more disappointed than anointed. That's, you know.
And by virtue that you were never disappointed at the Oscars, man, I love how you say that. It's like, there's going to be tons of people disappointed. I don't know what that feels like.
I've been disappointed at the Emmys, though.
You still have two of them at home.
Yeah, but, you know, the one that I still think I deserved head and shoulders above the other categories that year was for the Temptations miniseries.
Oh. You see the look on my face like, wait a minute, you did sound on that film?
Yeah, dog.
And didn't win?
The Rat Pack. And no one has seen the Rat Pack that I know of on the air since then, but the Temptations miniseries is almost always on that.
All right, bro. Okay. So now I got a new man. Russell should have won for that. Man, come on, man. That Temptation miniseries was amazing.
Oh, and also Dancing with Wolves was nominated for a BAFTA, and they sent us home empty. I didn't go to England. I'm like, I'm not going all the way.
All right, bro.
It was a good thing, you know.
All right.
But gentlemen, I wish I could hang out with you.
I know.
But I got to go deal with my paying job, you know.
All right, bro. Well, I will see you next week, man, because I think you've invited me and a couple of other local luminaries to be a part of the executive suite, man. So we will
talk.
Right,
the Critics Corner. And
yes,
it's going to be a hot discussion.
Yes, sir.
And we may live stream it. We're still trying to work that out. Then we'd get your permission slips. But first, we're trying to work out the technology.
So it's Ann Hornaday, Arch Campbell, myself, and Shereen Nicole. Am I correct?
That's affirmative. Yep. And
all right.
A hell of a discussion.
All right, sir. Hey, man, enjoy the show. Come on by to the Oscar DC Film Society if you don't want to watch it at home alone.
That might be something. I'm gonna call my good friend Tim Gordon and make sure I can get in.
I think Charles Kirkland, who's on the committee, says you are covered.
You are come covered, bro.
Bring right, the wife with right. you too.
Thank you, because Charles, Tim will forget.
So yes. All right, so brother, go ahead on to that paying gig, man, and we'll talk.
All right, now, thanks for the invite, sir.
Not a problem, man.
No problem, brother.
All right, Charles.
All right. So, guys. All right, and of course, that is two-time Oscar winner, two-time Emmy Award winner. If you've ever been to the National African-American Museum on the Mall here in D.C., there are two Oscars behind the glass that belong to Russell Williams that he has donated for a limited amount of time.
Yeah.
He's getting his Oscars back. before we get out of here, move on to our next segment, one quick story about his Oscars. Years ago, the late Joe Barber and I were doing an Oscar show over at WETA, our PBS affiliate here in D.C. And I called Russell up. I was like, hey, man, you got the – this is before the African-American Museum, so his Oscars were home. I was like, okay. Hey, man, can we borrow your Oscars for the show? He was like, sure. So just as we're about to get them, they made a phone call, and next thing you know – You do not display our stuff. I was like, come on, Academy, because I wanted to. I have never held one in my hand, and my friend has too. I'm like, dude. So I guess when he gets them back, I just go to his house, man, with some white gloves on and be like, yeah, ballin'.
With a guy in shades standing behind you.
Oh, man. Well, no big deal. All right, man, let's get on out of here. I'm going to take a break right now. We're going to come back on the other side, and it is going to be time for us to listen and talk to the cast of Birds of Prey.
Hot dog.
The actual co-stars who kick so much butt in this Harley Quinn film. You guys, keep it where you got it. You are listening to an extended edition of Overtime. And, of course, we'll be right back.
This is easy as it looks. Books and books around concepts and hooks. Session to session to get thoughts manifesting. Stressing and stressing to hit the world with a blessing. A lot of people often ask, cool, but how you giving back? The way I give back is through the knowledge of my raps, like a gym. For all my people caught out on the limb, who be giving in, caught out on the stem, who don't wanna win. I'm feeling you, I know you getting down like that. But what I'm saying, dog, is let me hold a little something black. I hit you back. Come on, dead dad, that's the 10th time I heard that. All you know is give me, I work hard for every penny that I make. Video and tape, LP and CD. If I fall, you feeding me? No dough to spread, always keep a level head. Long as my seeds get fed, it won't go to my head. So, everybody love a star when he.
All right. Welcome back to the Overtime edition of The Big Show. And coming up in our next segment, we have a review of Uppity, the Willie T. Ribbs documentary that is now streaming on Netflix. Definitely check that out, so you want to stay around for that review. But right now, our show correspondent, Wilson Morales, sat down with the actual Birds of Prey, the ladies who support Harley Quinn, played by Margot Robbie in the film. It is Wilson Morales sitting down with Mary Elizabeth Winstead, Rosie Perez, and Journey Smollett-Bell, and here's their conversation.
Obviously, the three of you come together at some point during the movie, you know, and you're no stranger to doing an action film, but for two of you, this is new for a lot of fans, you know, so what was it like coming onto this film and being loose?
Action before here in the UK, actually. I had a TV series here with Jack Whitehall where I played an aging bounty hunter. It's a comedy, you can live. And but it pales in comparison to what was required for Birds of Prey. And on day one, I got injured, I tore my meniscus disc, and the people of 8711 was like, we got you, we're gonna rebuild you. And they did, but it was very, very hard. It was very difficult, you know. And I got so much inspiration by the other girls here, you know, because they were just grinding every single day,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, yeah.
for me, stunts have always been something I've loved to do. You know, with Underground, even when I was pregnant, I was like, no, I'm doing all my stunts. My stunt woman's not stepping in. But, but again, nothing compares to being trained by 8711. I've never done anything like this. And we trained for over almost 5 months. And to step into these characters, you know, for me to play Black Canary, you can't just phone it in. Like, you gotta commit. And so that's what we all did, and put our bodies through very strenuous training. But, you know, Black Canary is one of the baddest iconic fighters. She's a street fighter, mixed martial artist. And so you gotta just throw your body in. And it was painful, but so thrilling and necessary in order to do justice to the character, because they have these skills, you know, and 8711, they're some of the best stunt team in the business because they train you up so you can do mostly everything.
Speaking about commitment, you know, we'll start off with you. You know, when you're playing a comic book character, fans are expecting you to know your stuff. Yeah. You know, so I remember that scene in Entourage. They were like, if you don't know it, they're going to come after you. So how committed were you when you got the role into looking about everything you can about the character?
I think you have to. I think you have to go back and you have to get inspiration from the source material, ultimately, first and foremost. But Kathy also talked to me a lot about coming up with my own interpretation. So it had to come from that. It had to come from her backstory, come from the personality and how that manifests in the comic books, but also adding my own little flavor onto it, which I think is okay, because you look at the comic books, there's so many different iterations. There's so many different directions the character goes in over all these many, many years. So I think you can pick and choose, like, oh, okay, she's a little bit like that in this comic, she's a little bit like that in this one. And I think what we kind of found was this weird sense of humor that is there in the comics, but maybe doesn't come out of her mouth in the same way that it comes out of my mouth on screen. So I hope that I managed to do justice to who she was, you know, in her first incarnations, and also bring something a little bit of my own to it.
Between the three of you and the rest of the cast, you know, was there a point in time during the set when you're shooting this movie when you're just about to be relaxed, go out, hang out, you know, and then chow, yeah, even though not all of you guys are appearing all in the same scene together?
I know, God.
She plays with him.
Listen, we all just gravitated towards Rosie's environment. I mean, I think maybe it's just she's capable of creating such a safe space. So we found ourselves definitely in her trailer, taking shots sometimes, or, you know, being like, can we come to your couch? And
Mary and I are just like crying on her couch.
It's very easy to open up to. We're just like, Rosie.
And then she cooks us dinner. You're such a good cook. And so, I mean, we definitely, there's definitely a love affair going on.
Yeah. It's easy. Yeah. Just an effortless respect and love. And,
you know.
They're starting to look like each other.
We are, baby. Come on, we're the same person.
Morphing it, just so you know.
All right, and special thanks again to Wilson Morales, who sat down with the co-stars of Bird of Prey. That's Mary Elizabeth Winstead, Journey Smollett-Bell, and Rosie Perez. Birds of Prey is in theaters now. Check it out. We're going to take a break right now and come back with film reviews, or a review, and our final segment of Overtime. You guys keep it where you got it. We'll be right back.
Can I kick it?
Yes, you can.
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 Well, I'm gone.
Oh, yeah.
Can I kick it? To all the people who can quest like a tribe does. Before this, did you really know what live was? Comprehend to the track force, why? Cause getting mentions on the tip of the vibe buzz. Rock and roll to the beat of the funk fuzz. Wipe your feet really good on the rhythm rug. If you feel the urge to freak, do the jitterbug. Come and spread your arms if you really need a hug.
All right, and welcome back to the Overtime edition of Keeping It Real with Film Gordon. And in this week's show, we have one review. And, of course, that is Uppity, the Willie T. Ribbs story. But before we begin, as always, cue the music.
Hello,
right. Uppity, the Willie T. Ribbs story, is a documentary that profiles a defiant driver who challenged racial barriers in American auto racing, becoming the first black man to race in the Indy 500. Of course, it's a documentary that stars Willie T. Ribbs and is directed by Nate Adams and Adam Carolla. And here is a clip from Uppity.
Muhammad Ali, he said to me, "You're going to deal with some challenges for one reason only. You're in an all-white sport." In England, I won the Formula Ford Series. No one could beat me.
You came back knowing I just accomplished something that very few Americans have, and no one would give him a shot.
About that time period we were in the 70s, there was still a lot of segregationists.
Next week, I'm going to put Jews in
it. I get a phone call from a promoter in Charlotte, North Carolina. "We're going to get some attention down here, and you're the guy that's going to bring it." There was death threats. "If this nigger races in this race, he might not leave alive."
It probably felt like it's me against the world.
"You want a reason not to like me? I want to give you one."
Our leader once again, Willie T. Ribbs, out in front. Willie T. Ribbs, his fourth victory in the Trans Am Series. We have a winner of the Texas Challenge Trans Am.
"If you don't want me in your sport, then beat me."
Willie T. Ribbs is finally on it.
My ultimate goal is IndyCar.
There was a lot of guys on that team that did not want to see Willie in that race car.
I knew he was an executioner.
"Looks like we have a blown engine."
"Yeah, looks like Willie T. Ribbs."
"We were out of money and out of everything."
"Do you think he'll get in? Just a gut feel. Are they going to make it or not?"
"It's so hard."
"I drove him to turn one for qualifying, and I pegged it. I'm either in the race or you peel me off the cement."
"There is no sport more exciting than racing. This is the next best thing to heaven."
They called me Uppity, and I loved it.
All right, this film, checked it out on Netflix early this week. And of course, you know, for people who are really young and don't know the legend of Willie T. Ribbs, Willie T. Ribbs, the best way to explain it is that he's not the first African-American auto racer, because somebody like Wendell Scott, who Richard Pryor starred in Grease Lightning, would have predated Willie T. Ribbs. But Willie T. Ribbs is almost like the Tiger Woods of the game. You know, he's like in the modern era, like a young, charismatic African-American out of San Jose, California, who always had a hankering to race, and having to deal with the exact same obstacles that a Jackie Robinson dealt with, trying to integrate baseball, dealing with what Clifton Sweetwater, forget his last name, the basketball player for the Knicks. Stop. We're cutting that part out. Cutting that out because I can't remember what his name is. So we'll stay with the Jackie Robinson, who integrated baseball. Okay, 3, 2, 1. Also think about the difficulties that Tiger Woods had following a Calvin Pete when he began his career as a golfer in 1997. Willie T. Ribbs was the same in the late 1970s. And the story is actually told first person through Willie T. Ribbs, who is now, I don't know how old Willie T. Ribbs may be now, 50 or 60 at this point, but him recalling all the challenges and struggles that he went through trying to race in the Formula Atlantic, that circuit, and then briefly almost having a shot to race NASCAR before they pulled him at the very end, and then him finding success, and as I said, becoming the first black man to race in the Indy 500. It's, I mean, I hate to say it this way, the challenges that he goes through, none of this stuff is surprising. You know, all athletes who have, in any sport, who've ever tried to integrate an all-white sport, have had these difficulties. Willie Reed with hockey, they've all had these difficulties. I like the candor and the swagger that Willie T. Ribbs brings to the game, and I think that's exactly what must have rubbed his contemporaries the wrong way. That not only was could he talk it, but he could absolutely race it and walk it. And so I just think it's a fascinating look at the life of a man who was a pioneer in a sport that still to this day, I mean, you know, we have some African-Americans that are driving on the circuit now, but they're still dealing with the difficulties, and it's a little easier for them than it was for Willie T. Ribbs. So I would absolutely give this movie a B. I thought it was a really well-told story that has a lot of the fellow drivers that drove with him on the circuit there at the same time. The story is called Uppity because that's what they called him. Uppity, you know what. So check it out. It is streaming on Netflix right now. It is called Uppity, the Willie T. Ribbs story, and it's definitely worth your time. Check it out. That's all I got for this latest edition of Overtime. And on behalf of our producer, Shane Lewis, and associate producer, Charles Kirkland, as I tell you guys every week, please see something good at the movies. And we'll be back next week with more of Keeping It Real with Film Gordon. Have a nice weekend.